might describe a typical Big Star session for me during the third sessions?
Well, I don't know. They were all different. Although we tracked much of the material at one time, I mean, during one period of time. We recorded over what must have been 3 or 4 months. It has been so long ago that I've lost track of it all. But it was like we started in the fall, and we ended just before spring, I would guess. And of course, we didn't record all that time. But Alex came to me with all of the songs on a demo that was just him and an electric guitar split, like his voice on one track and the guitar on the other track. It was like Fry had purposely made the demo non-musical, you know, for whatever reason. And people accuse Alex of not being prepared on this record. He had all the songs on the initial demo except the covers. And Stroke It Noel was a different song. I mean, it had different lyrics. And he didn't. He rewrote the lyrics after we put the violins on, which, of course, is what Stroke It Noel means. He was talking about Noel Gilbert, the violin player, who was a friend of his father's. And but all of the songs were demoed before we ever started. So, I mean, Alex had it as a song cycle, if you see what I mean. I mean, it was obviously supposed to be a body of work. And there were two songs that we never cut because we weren't finished. We didn't get to finish. Fry stopped us. The last song that we recorded was Dream Lover, which was not on the demo. That was a new song that he, in fact, that when he sung it in the studio, he said it was the third time that he had performed the song. And he said he ruined it because we should have recorded the second time that he sang the song. He sang it for Lisa, and he sang it for somebody else, and he said the second time was the performance. And he wouldn't. I was playing live on that. I was playing pump organ. Alex was playing piano, and Lee Baker was playing guitar, and he wouldn't even tell Lee what key it was in. And it was a totally spontaneous moment. And then, of course, we overdubbed the violins. And Jody was playing drums. But there was no really typical tracking. The major tracking band was Jody and Alex and Tommy Cathy. And then some of Cathy's parts were replaced. And there was a black bass player from Memphis State, a jazz player, upright player, named John something. I can't remember his name. It's on the record. He was an overdub. He didn't play live on anything. He's the other major bass player. And I played bass on Jesus Christ and on something else, Dana. And Tommy McClure is playing on Femme Fatale and a whole lot of Shaken. So there really was no typical tracking session. We did most of the tracking in Studio B at Arden before it was turned inside out. Some of it was cut in A, but most of it was cut in B, and most of the overdubbing was done in A. And we mixed it all in A. Don't ask me something else.
on the third album, some of the songs sound very together. Such as Dana and Kissimmee and some of the more rocking songs. And then some of the songs, like you mentioned earlier, Dream Lover and a Whole Lot of Shaking, seem to be almost drug-influenced.
How could you suggest that? A Whole Lot of Shaking was inspired. Alex, I may be wrong about this. I believe Alex and Jerry Lee Lewis have the same birthday. I think I'm right about that. If not the same, very close. And Alex went to Jerry Lee's birthday party at Hernando's Hideaway with Lisa and his bodyguard, and a fight ensued. And they got thrown out, which Alex really enjoyed. And that's what caused us to record a Whole Lot of Shaking. And we cut it with Jody playing drums, and then we overdubbed Tarp Tarrant, who was Jerry Lee's drummer for years. And it did. The last, that's when, was overdubbing on a Whole Lot of Shaking where we might have bridged the gap of conservative taste, and Fry made a stop. That was the last thing that, although as I said, Dream Lover was the last song we cut. The last incident was when we were overdubbing a background vocal part for a Whole Lotta Shakin'. And in the way it's presented on the Ryko disc, Whole Lotta Shakin' is the last cut, the last bonus cut, which makes it sort of like an over-the-top encore, you know, which I kind of like that. I like the way the Ryko disc is sequenced. Some of the looser songs, though, really were very structured. Like Femme Fatale was recorded with Alex playing a gut string guitar and singing, and me playing drums and nothing else. Everything else is overdubbed. And that's the one that Cropper's playing guitar on. And I took, and I'm sure Steve had no idea. He never heard the song, didn't know who Lou Reed was. He just played. I took six tracks of his guitar and mixed them down to one. And the same thing with McClure. I'm positive McClure had no idea who Lou Reed was. And literally the lead instrument on the track is the bass. We spent more time overdubbing the finger pops on that song than we did, you know, anything else. Alex is meticulous about that kind of thing. Studied subtleties, you know. Well, Oh Dana there are two songs on the record that have what you could call, I guess, found lyrics. Jesus Christ Was Born Today, Alex wrote the song by turning the pages of the Broadman hymnal and taking a line from each page almost randomly. And Oh Dana, most of Big Star Third is about Lisa Aldridge, who was the girl that Alex was going with at the time, and really the degeneration of their relationship. And during this, you know, 3 or 4 month period of time, Alex took up with this other girl whose name was Dana something. I don't know. She was from East Memphis. And she kind of spoke in these non sequitur lines, and that's what Oh Dana is. Alex, during, I think it was only a week that he went with her, or snuck around with her, basically, and he wrote down things that she said, and every line in that song is something that this girl said, you know, and Alex fit it together in his genius way. I've got tremendous respect for Alex as a lyricist. It's too bad he doesn't write anymore. To kind of set this up, when Ryko Disc, in my opinion, the record has never been released, because the two vinyl European releases and the subsequent CDs were done with no input from Alex or me or anyone else, really. And so they were not sequenced, and the right songs were not included. And so really, the Ryko Disc is the first release of Big Star Third, which Big Star Third, I don't know what that means. Nobody meant to call it that. Just a name that came from somewhere. I don't know who came up with that. Sister Lovers was discussed, but nobody liked the name. The name, when I went back and looked at my notes, which is kind of scary to think that I still have notes from sessions that were that long ago, but I do. Alex's idea for a name, which I'm not sure that he ever nailed it down, but his idea for a name that I wrote down was Beale Street Green, which referred to the area out there on Beale Street where they tore the buildings down, when the grass grew up and they used to have music festivals out there. And that was the working title of the album. But Alex and I had very different ideas about which songs to be included and which to be excluded. And neither of us ever intended for it to be a double album. Some people have said that it was cut as a double album. That's not true. And the reason we cut too many songs was, emotionally, Alex, I think, had to cut some of those songs to get to other songs, if you see what I mean. I mean, it was all, I think what I did for him as a producer was remove the yoke of oppression that he'd always been under, whether it was Dan Penn or Terry Manning or John Fry. Someone had held him back. and I encouraged him to stretch. And I've been accused of indulging him. I don't believe I indulged him, but I did free him up artistically, I think, to where he could go further with his own ideas. I mean, you got to consider Alex had been working in a recording studio one way or the other since he was 14 or 15. He'd seen an awful lot of high-level recording, and he knew how to do more than he was ever allowed to do. The first two Big Star records, this is probably heresy to say, but in my opinion, the first two Big Star records are very boring. I think the songs are good. Some of the performances are good. The production is non-existent. I think once he saw what I was capable of letting him do, if you get my drift, then his horizon expanded to the point where he wanted to record things that he knew we weren't going to use, just to exercise himself or to get to another creative level. So, as I say, we both had very different ideas of which songs to include, and You Can't Have Me, Alex didn't intend to include, which I always did. He thought it was too brutal, I think was the word he said. Cruel, maybe. It was specifically, I guess, you know, obviously about Lisa. And towards the end of the project, he started removing Lisa, her participation from the record. He would go in and erase things that she had done. And in fact, the only thing that remains, I think, is her voice on Femme Fatale, which I insisted on. And he did the same thing on Flies on Sherbert, where Lisa was very much more involved. She played instruments on Flies on Sherbert. And towards the end of the project, Alex went in and removed her parts. Because it was like, I think it was sort of like cutting the extra songs. He was using her musical part to get to some other musical part. But You Can't Have Me was one of the ones that he wanted to leave off. The reason that I didn't sequence the Ryko disc release was because when I consulted my notes, I saw what I had wanted to leave off, and I was definitely wrong. I don't think either one of us ever got a full, either Alex or I, ever got a full picture of what the record really was. But as I say, we never really finished. But I wanted to leave off Nighttime, some of the softer songs, which are now my favorite, my favorites on the record. I think, Nighttime is sheer genius. I think one of the reasons that this record has endured is, there are several reasons, but I think Alex's performances on this record are consistently spectacular. And the consistency is something that he lost in his subsequent records. He was, there are flashes of brilliance in the latter records, but Big Star Third, or whatever you want to call it, top to bottom, his performance is seamless. It's like he did it all at once. The other reasons I think that the record has endured is that it's a monument to John Frey's engineering. It was the last record that John did hands-on, start to finish. He mixed the Scruffs after that, and he did some other, records where he was involved marginally. But he engineered Big Star Third top to bottom. There are other engineers listed in the credits because, myself included, some of us did overdubs and things like that. But all the tracking and all the mixing, which is brilliant, was done by Fry. And it was very difficult for him emotionally. And after the sessions were over, I just don't think he had anything left. I think in the newspaper, Jody described Big Star Third as Big Star's primal scream, which I think is very insightful of Jody. But it wasn't just Big Star's primal scream, because it was Fry's swan song as an engineer as well. And I think the emotional fiber of the record is very deep and revealing, and I think that's what people identify with. The other person that's always left out in discussions of this record is Carl Marsh, who arranged all the strings and played all the woodwinds, the saxophone recorder. And when I went back and listened for the Ryko disc release, I was amazed by really his contribution, because he was never there. I mean, he did his parts, you know, and then he split. So I don't think of him when I think about the record, because it was agonizing and long hours in the studio. Also, when I listened to the Ryko disc, I was amazed how many instruments I played. I should have made more money. That goes without saying.